Catch new episodes of Dial the Gate weekends at youtube.com/dialthegate. And for the latest schedule, visit dialthegate.com. Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 200 and something of Dial the Gate. I'm losing track. I'm getting so high up there. I think it's 229. The number is right in front of me, and then I forget it 10 seconds later. Welcome to 40. My name is David Reed. Thank you so much for joining me. I have David Hewlett, Dr. Rodney McKay from Stargate Atlantis, and Tech Bandits joining me, as well as Mika McKinnon, science consultant for Stargate. I'm really excited about this one because everyone's been saying, when are you going to get them back on? I'm like, you know what? That's a good idea. But before I bring them in, if you enjoy Stargate and you want more content like this on YouTube, click that like button. It makes a difference with the show and really helps us grow our audience. Please also consider sharing this video with a Stargate friend, and if you want to get notified about future episodes, click the subscribe icon. And giving the bell icon a click will give you a notification of any last minute guest changes, and clips from this live will give you a notification the moment a new video drops. And clips from this live stream will be released over the course of the next few weeks on both the Dial the Gate and GateWorld.net YouTube channels. As this is a live stream, we have moderators in the chat. I think we've got a full house here standing by to take your questions, science related questions preferably for David and Mika, although if you have any life related questions, you know, you can certainly ask them too, especially with Mika here. She has been busy. How are you guys doing? Hello, Mika. Hello, David.
How are
doing
you?
Pretty well.
Wow, Mika, who is this?
This is the newest member of the household who's just gonna snooze through everything.
Wow,
hopefully.
That's a good baby.
We have an emergency flamingo to deploy if necessary.
Unleash the bird.
Exactly. That and the noise-canceling headphones going on.
There you go. And David Hewlett, Dr. Rodney McKay of Stargate Atlantis, sage of leadership and depleting ZPMs. How are you, sir?
A few words on leadership. Yes, it's all about power and leadership for me. That's what it all boils down to eventually.
You doing good?
I am, yeah. I mean, it's weird times. Industry, okay. Very weird times in the industry and the world for that matter. But yeah, it's I'm muddling along okay, trying to figure stuff out.
How is Tech
I find
Bandits?
I lose myself in the science. Great. Yeah, actually really fun. I had one of my oldest Tech Bandits come in yesterday and set up this CNC machine and look at some PC problems for me and stuff. And it's just amazing. Like, this is a little guy my son and him used to sit on my elliptical. They used to stand on the elliptical. They were small enough to both be on a foot, and they'd go up and down with the elliptical. And now he's teaching me stuff about PCs that I didn't know. So it's really fun. And I got some stuff at a local community center that my son set me up at now. So I go in there and do some stuff there as well. So I'm just loving it.
You know,
absolutely love it.
You never stop learning, and
that's it.
Especially from like even the smaller people can still teach you. Mika, have you ever, as a scientist, do you ever quit learning?
Oh, of course not. Yeah. And of course, now it also turns into, like, instead of doing rock tasting notes for adults, I also now have to consider rock tasting notes for toddlers.
Yeah.
And the unique challenges of, okay, yes, technically that's safe to lick, but don't chew it and don't swallow it.
Right.
Or okay, yes, we can eat this rock. It's called ice. And we're going to get a nice synthesized sample from the freezer, so it's less contaminated, but it's still a rock, I promise.
Applied chemistry.
Exactly. The most lickable rocks, salt and water.
Oh, it is weird how they're just like magnets for anything that they shouldn't be into. I used to joke with Baz that you could have him in a completely padded, cushioned cell and he would find a pin. You know what I mean? Like they can always find a way to hurt themselves. It's amazing.
They tend to want to seek out the undiscovered countries. You know, wherever there is a potential for new learning. Ooh, that's interesting. Let's go do that.
Yeah.
So
new learning or new diseases. We're big on bringing those home, too. I love that, too. Little Petri dishes.
Mika, I have a... Yeah, go ahead, Mika.
Oh, I was going to say, what I love about this is, all right, so we're teasing that little kids do this, but they have to learn literally about everything in the entire universe, right? Like, they have to learn what gravity is and that shadows mean something is deep and all of that. But we still harness that curiosity. Like, I swear that everybody goes through a rock collecting phase, and some people grow out of it at 3 years old, and some of it, people have it for the rest of their lives and turn into geoscientists. But yeah. We as a species literally go out and collect rocks from other places in the universe. We just did another asteroid sample return mission where we just spent literally billions of dollars to go and get that cool rock from space.
Yeah, that's the OSIRIS-REx? Talking about the OSIRIS-REx mission?
Oh, so we fantastic. Did both Bennu and OSIRIS-REx of, not Bennu, Habiyashu-2 to going to asteroid Ryugu, and then OSIRIS-REx to Bennu.
Yeah, there was
they
the Japanese one.
Yeah. And then we traded samples between them because we weren't sure whether either rock collecting mission would be successful. We're like, here, look, I'll share mine with you. You share yours with me. And hopefully
and Canada we'll got a chunk. Canada got a chunk because they contributed the some laser system for mapping the asteroids or something. Yeah.
Which is kind of so the fun Canucks because, like, previously we were all about the grippy claws, so that we're expanding out now and also doing, like, laser maps is kind of fun. Yeah. We're not just grippy claws anymore.
You know,
it is fascinating, isn't it? It's just absolutely marvelous.
Yeah, it's wild. Our dip into the cosmos is not unlike a toddler exploring his first surroundings. You know, we got to start small with the grasping, and then we work our way up to the lasers and the atomic bombs. So,
you know. We're kind of at that tasting phase right now, aren't we? We're sort of at that point where we're beginning to analyze stuff on the planet. So we're sort of almost tasting the rocks at this point.
Oh, yeah. Except for we taste them with lasers, which just makes it so much more cool. Like,
oh, I know. I know.
Like the Mars 2020 mission is also that rover is going around. First of all, it's building little piles of cute rocks, being like, this one, this is a special rock. You should come back and get it because, really? You know, it didn't come with pockets. So it's building little rock piles for another one to come by and get it, which is definitely the toddler mentality of, like, look, I can't carry all these cool rocks. Wow. So I'll put them in a pile and mom and dad will carry them later. So NASA now needs to build the mom and dad robot to go and, like, collect the stockpile and bring it home.
It's like bringing the lunchbox into school because they forgot it. Yeah, I know that. I know that feeling very well. Yeah,
that's true.
But it is. It's true. Like, we're like toddlers. I mean, I've got to say, I'm much more excited about these sort of robotic adventurers rather than the humans. I don't understand why we feel the need to at this point be throwing us bags of chemicals into space as well, because it just takes up so many resources, and I feel there's so many more cool things we could be doing with these robots and really getting us sussing out the land and even building things for us for when we show up. I think right now there's this weird kind of macho mentality of, like, we got to get into space, we got to be out there floating around like useless bags of water, you know what I mean? So I much prefer these robotic things.
I kind of appreciate that we've just flat out declared that space tourism is a thing, because having astronauts in space, like, I would love to be an astronaut. I applied to be an astronaut.
Me too. I'd love to be as well.
It'd be super fun. But it is more about PR than it is about actual science. Like, robots are way better at the types of things we need to be doing right now. And I mean, there's so many cool missions we could do. There's a chunk of the Venus atmosphere where, if you're at the right height, it's actually Earth pressure. So you could have, like, little blimps up there at, like, Earth atmospheric pressure hanging out. And that the Venus clouds are so thick, we're pretty sure that you could have, say, I mean, you're definitely going to have all sorts of weird little crystals and minerals up in there. But you could have, like, bacteria living in the clouds of Venus. And wouldn't it be really fun to go explore and see and find out? Or at least map Venus properly. Like, we haven't sent something there since before I was born.
Right.
So,
what about Io? Is that attainable as
I
well?
I would love to go there.
Yeah.
I would, honestly, it would be so much fun. Like, just go check out the volcanoes in other places.
Yeah.
The volcanoes here? You're done with the volcanoes here? You're ready to move on to other planets?
Well, I would like to see what's the same and what's different, right? Like, you can't build patterns if you only have one set.
Yeah.
It's, again, the toddler mentality of, okay, this is the only world I've ever seen. This is the only, like, the only type of family I've ever seen. Thus, all families look like mine. You get them a whole bunch of books to, like, look at different types of families. We aren't at that stage. We need to go looking for it.
We've only got one Petri dish. We need more Petri dishes to look at.
Exactly, exactly. Like, we know things like the slope of the volcanoes on Mars are the same if you account for the different gravity of the volcanoes in Hawaii. So we know that the basic chemistry of that volcano is the same. But whereas, like, Olympus Mons means if it's the same basic geology as here on Earth, it's like the little hot spot there was stable for billions of years, just building up in one place over and over and over. Whereas for us on Earth, we've got the Emperor Hawaii chain that moved, and it's been active for a long time, but not in one place because of the sheet on top kept moving, the tectonic plate on top kept moving.
Well, and forcing it to come out in different places?
Yeah, and it's not that billions of years. So is there something about being still and stable in one place that let that hot spot stay for longer? But like, does the movement kind of extinguish it over time? Or is it just, hey, that was a quirk and one happens to be longer than the other? I don't know.
Are there plates on Mars as well? Is it the same kind of a structure as Earth that way? Are there,
So nothing is moving. We sent the Mars InSight was the geophysics lander. So it was, in terms of profession, it was the same profession as me. It was my little robotic avatar. So it landed, and its entire job was to stay very, very, very silent for years, listening for earthquakes. And it would use those earthquakes as like a bat doing sonar to map things out. It would use those earthquakes to map out the inside of Mars. And what it figured out is that it has a very thin crust. So we have a crust on Earth that the tectonic plates go moving around. It's got a very thin crust, but that thin crust is really dry and broken. So it's more like the moon than like Earth. That the only tectonic plate movement that happens is the whole planet going crunching down as it cooled off.
Right.
But we think that Venus has active tectonics. We think that not only does it have active tectonics, it has like the entire surface of the planet rolls over active tectonics. But we don't know because we haven't sent anything else to go mapping it. So we're looking at like really low resolution maps from the 70s being like, maybe I can see a line. I don't know.
Why have we given up on that, do you think? Like, why are we so... Is it because everyone's just focused on Mars? Is it
heat, maybe? Would our technology tolerate the atmosphere?
Well, I mean, we landed things in the 70s. Yeah. Of course, the only picture from the... we've gotten a couple of pictures from the surface of Venus before the robots melted. But the only attempt to sample on Venus, the robot popped off its lens cap and then went to go take a sample and took a sample of its own lens cap.
No. Oh, that's great.
Yes.
That's the kind of way I would take photographs.
Exactly. So it's the only sample ever taken on Venus was
of itself. Of a lens cap. My God, it's made out of lens cap. All of it.
All the way down.
It is extraordinary to me the amount of detail that they have to go into for these landers. Like just the amount of absolutely everything has to be, they have to try to think of basically everything. It's just extraordinary the amount of sort of ingenuity that goes into this stuff. I mean, who'd have thought? What are the chances of a lens cap falling off right where you want to take your sample? And of course, you don't think of that kind of stuff until you've just spent a few million dollars to send it up there and have it do that. Like they say, it's very easy to get something to do something once, but to do it consistently is much more difficult, right?
Yeah. So. Yep.
That is just wild, Mika. I have a question from one of my. Team General Maximus, given your love of science,
General Maximus.
Yes, exactly. Given your love of science and exploration, if the Stargate program existed in real life, would you want to be a member of one of the SG science teams and be on the front line of discovery? Or would you want to be doing something else in the sphere? Like staying back and monitoring everything that came back?
So when I was younger, I definitely would have been a fieldwork person. And I love the idea of like extraterrestrial fieldwork is just so cool. But now I've got small little monsters. I have to come home and read them bedtime stories at night every night. And I can't, risk bringing home alien pathogens. I don't even want to risk bringing home earthly pathogens. Thank you very much.
I'll handle that for you. That's fine.
Exactly, exactly. I don't need to have the additional risk of like introducing gaol symbiotes to my toddler. That just is not on my list of I don't need to suddenly be raising an ancient Egyptian god and asking them to not spit on the playground. That's
oh, that's funny.
Toddlers are challenging enough without that particular quirk. So I think I'd definitely be the stay-at-home aspect of things. Okay. But I would love it if we could, like, I'd also be very much in favor of sending more of the robots, right? Yeah, like, there's some great robots in Stargate. And, like, even just the little cameras, just send all the little cameras going everywhere. You can get a lot with just pictures. And I mean, it wouldn't be that much to add on some geophysical equipment. It's in Vancouver right now. We've got like this whole set of people on social media being like, oh no, there's helicopters with long pointy noses doing close laying flying right now. And it's like, yes, yes, that's the LiDAR mapping to make sure all the transmission lines are fine. That's literally bouncing lasers off the ground to be like, here is the ground. The ground is there. The ground is there. The ground is there. There's the transmission line. It's still standing. Yay! We don't have any gas leaks. Woohoo! Like, you can do that on an alien planet. That would be super amazing to just do, like, super high-quality maps.
They doing that with the little helicopter on, is it Curiosity?
Yeah. So Curiosity is, the Mars 2020 rover is popping it up and over. Perseverance? Oh, no.
Was it Perseverance? I get them. I'm so old, there's too many names that all sound very inspirational. Yeah, exactly. They all sound, the latest inspirational robot that went up there.
Exactly. The Mars 2020 robot.
But it would, as you say, like, it would be just nice to have maps of them. And imagine having maps of these things. I mean, it's fascinating to me also, I find that there are discoveries being made from data that came in 20 years ago. Like, we're able to now process such large amounts of data compared to, and we've got these AIs that will actually, machine learning models that will actually help make sense of these, you know, this fire hose of data that we have. It's just, it's extraordinary to see people, like, discovering things on a computer that was observed, you know, 10 years ago in space.
It's that the data's been there all along, but we didn't know how to look at it. And that's somewhere that AI is really good and really awesome. Yeah. It's helping us find patterns. Turns out some things pattern recognition really useful to get better at. Other times, doesn't really help you.
Well, the fact that we can use these tools to teach certain pattern behavior and have it recognize things that we wouldn't be able to normally see just going through it, I think that's one of the things that's amazing. The technology that we have coming along now, where we can put cameras on farm equipment and target specific plants that need pesticides and herbicides, and we end up saving our consumption of those materials by like 80%, you know, in some cases because we're targeting specific plants because we've taught these AI to pay attention to what each plant needs. I mean, resource management is huge.
Funny thing is that whenever we solve something with AI, it stops becoming AI. Like, as soon as you say, like, you know, it's we've got a smart tractor that can sort of pick out the weeds type thing. They go like, oh, that's just part of the smart tractor. That's no longer like an AI at work. Mm. AI is always this thing down the road somewhere. You know what I mean? Mm. We start accepting this stuff as we go along. It's all machine learning, but I think there's almost a need now for people to distance themselves from AI because there is so much misinformation and confusion and I think fear around it as well. It's kind of when you could see it doing something simple like, oh, it's identifying that plant, it goes, oh, that's the plant, but you don't want that plant, we'll get rid of it, done, great. And you start talking about that with people, it's a very different story.
Well, I think you want it to do all the really boring mundane tasks like stare at every single plant or go through every single photograph comparing for tiny one pixel differences. Like, fantastic. Set the robots the boring jobs and free up like the creative fun ones for people.
And the backbreaking stuff.
Like the idea of outsourcing writing to robots. You're like, but the storytelling and the creative, like, or outsourcing art to robots, you know, but that's the fun bit. That's the funny thing bit for the humans to do.
Yeah, the funny thing about that though.
Bad job, not the fun jobs.
The funny thing about that, though, is that I feel like that's the difference between art and commerce, right? I mean, when the worst thing that happened to film and TV was that it started being referred to as content.
Yeah.
And it didn't matter what it was. It just mattered how many eyeballs you had on it, how much money it made. So I think there was always going to be a human voice needed, because that's art into itself. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, AI can do art. It can do some fabulous stuff. It's amazing. It's extraordinary. It's still AI art. I still want to see what's happening in someone else's. I want that personal experience. I want someone's uniquely human story on this stuff. And I don't think that's, I think there will be a lot more content out there. Mika and I were talking about this before earlier, where, you know, YouTube is being inundated with a lot of this pseudoscience nonsense that's being generated by AI. The images have been randomly stuck together to work with it. And it's just being posted online. And eventually that's going to become a huge problem, because it's just making stuff up faster than we could ever make the discoveries that we need to make that would counter them, right?
How do you
and
sort through the
that
noise?
Sound plausible.
Yeah.
Well, it's all about this.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the idea of the pattern recognition. So it finds what phrases and ideas and structures that we use to tell these stories and communicate these ideas. And it mimics that with random information jabbed in. So it all sounds plausible. So it turns into this question of, the part that you cannot outsource is the curation. It's we talk about this a lot in disasters of trust networks. I used to say before the pandemic that the number one thing that you could do to reduce your to increase your survivability during a major catastrophe is throw house parties and invite your neighbors, because the very, very first responders on scene aren't the police or the firefighters or the paramedics. It's literally the people who are across the street or in the next apartment over who see that something is happening and can go there. That when things are truly catastrophic, it's having this connection with
such
your neighbors who know, like, that the person on the fifth floor is physically disabled and will need somebody to help them out if the elevators go down, or that somebody in that house over there is one parent with three kids at home. And if things are going south, they really need to have somebody go be a secondary adult with them. Those interpersonal relationships are key to survivability. And we actually see this in things like giant earthquakes in Japan. The neighborhoods that have a tradition of having tea parties or mahjong, or things where you get the physical neighbors together, have greater survivability than the neighborhoods where it's a more transient population or a more isolated population.
Yeah.
It's a little bit different phrasing now that we have a post-pandemic world where we're worried about respiratory infections and things like that. That community resilience aspect is still true. That also works with curation and content and trust, in that I know you and you know me, and we have this, wow, I don't even want to admit how long relationship now, like over a decade and a half that we've known each other. And that if there's aspects of the film industry that I'm trying to understand, because yes, I've been doing this a decade and a half, but it's not my full-time thing. I would go to you and ask you things, and I would trust that you would be able to tell me how things work. And that if you're trying to understand, like, is this real science or not, that you have this scientist, you know, and yes, it might not be my specific specialty, but you know, I can figure out and evaluate it and be able to pop back to you being like, yeah, this is real. No, it is not. That those personal trust networks, and then they extend out of, well, your son's friends are asking a science question that nobody in their network knows, but you know somebody to ask, and it might not be who I know, but I know a lot of scientists and I can ask someone, and then we play this game of telephone, but it's a trust network of telephone. And that, again, is something that it's just going to increase in importance as the information gets more cloudy. It's how do you find that signal in the noise? You have to find specialists who know how.
One of the things I added to Tech Bandits as my sort of little mission was to inspire the next generation of brilliant minds, but also through different perspectives. Because I think it's so important truth isn't presented, truth is discovered. Like, you have to find the components you need. Like you say, you have to refer to the people who know this stuff to get to the truth. You can't just take it at face value. In fact, that's the very nature of being a scientist, isn't it? Is that you question everything. That's the fun of it, is you go like, oh, I wonder how that works. Wait a sec, are you sure it works? You know, like that's the beauty of it. And especially nowadays where the information is just fast. It is problem with the internet is that it is so easy to put out something that isn't true. It takes us not that you can do it before you've even finished the thought. to put out something that's knowledgeable, that's well researched, and that is actually of use to people, takes a long time to do it properly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's always going to be more crap out there than there is gold.
Mm-hmm. It's one of those things where so there used to be a job in journalism that was effectively a curation job where you just go out and you'd find a whole bunch of stories and you'd go, this is the news that's happening here, 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 here. And there's like, right. I did a 10-minute spent summary that's really just referencing three other articles, four other articles. Then you move on to the next one and the next one and the next one. Well, right. That job, it's dying off very fast because that's a perfect job for AI. If you can feed in good information in the first place, to do that syndication. But understanding what is interesting or important, that takes taste. And I don't think you can program taste very well.
Discernment. Yeah.
I tried to, like, so what I've been doing recently is doing an email, like try to do once a week. It's a way of sort of dealing with an ADD thing that I have, which is that I want to know everything. I want to read the entire internet. So to try to get myself to focus, what I've done is I've given myself a goal of every week I have to take a couple of stories that I found interesting and just dig into them a bit, get a sense of them, and then if I think it's sort of inspiring, I will share them in this email of awesome awesomeness that I do every week. And it's been amazing because what I've done is I've stopped going to social media for stories. I now just sign up for newsletters from the various different organizations that I'm interested in, whether it's chemistry or biotech or astronomy or any of these things. And I look through a newsletter from a trusted source. I read that story. I go, that's interesting. I could dive into it from there. It's not as quick. Like, one of the things I find frustrating is that every week I miss a good story because that's just come out.
Yeah.
You know, you're constantly behind because you've got your lips up to a fire hose of information. You're like trying to get a sip, but it's just, you know, it's like that dog with its head out of the window with the big lips flapping around. I mean, it's, you know, it's impossible. You need, as you say, I think it's so important to have people you trust who can find these things for you. And it's why scientists are so freaking important. You know, it's all very well and good for me to write and say stuff about this stuff, but, you know.
I will say, if you're doing the newsletters, then two I have to recommend because they're just so well written and so fun is Leah Crane writes one for New Scientist about recent astronomy discoveries, and her sense of humor is just spectacular. And then Bethany Brookshire writes one on human-animal interactions that I absolutely freaking love. And it's one of the few things that we were talking before about how parenting is the ultimate distraction. It's the only newsletter that I will actually finish all the way through, even though I get interrupted three times. Which, general, after I've been distracted once, that's it. I will, like, it's gone into the ether. I will find out about it, you know, 20 years from now when I'm no longer constantly
getting
interrupted.
Well, I remember almost reading about that. Yeah.
Exactly. So those two are definitely ones that need to be read.
Sorry. Well, do you know what they're called?
Bethany Brookshire's is on Substack, and then Leah Crane's is on New Scientist, and I can look up what the actual names of the newsletters are, but I know the people not
got their
names.
The peoples. That's okay. I got the people now, so that's good.
Exactly.
That's
good. Exactly.
Well, I'm always on the lookout because, I mean, I always have too much to read, but it's just nice to have, I just like to be able to sort of pick and choose things from different places. Otherwise, you just sort of end up always the same source, right?
Wow.
Exactly.
This is
so Bethany's is called Team Trash, and Leah's is...
Oh, really? Team Trash? That's great.
Yes. Well, so she specializes in how humans and animals interact, and actually she put together
Trash.
Yeah, exactly. So she put together an entire book called Pests, about how the concept of a pest is entirely human-driven, that the animals aren't doing anything, that it's how we interact with them, and that the same animal doing the same behavior in different places is or is not a pest. That here in North America, elephants cannot be a pest. It is impossible for an elephant to be a pest. An elephant is a cool exotic animal doing cool exotic things. But if you are a farmer in Africa, an elephant is absolutely a pest. Yeah. It is a giant upscaled rat that is destroying your crops and occasionally getting drunk and destroying your crops.
I saw that video. I was amazed at that. Kangaroos, too. Same thing, where we think they're the cutest thing in the world. But, man, those suckers, like the little like mighty mice.
Oh, man. Yeah.
And then in Terrifying Canada, things. A bear is a pest. A bear is somebody who is going to come and destroy your trash can and, like, maybe raid your kitchen and definitely be a hazard. But a bear is this adorable, cute, exotic animal if you're, say, in Europe and don't have to deal with them raiding your trash cans.
Jeez.
Where do we stand on rats? Because I got a couple who like to roam around here that are freaking me out a little bit. I find I name them. They're not nearly as terrifying to me as once I've named them.
Mika.
Yeah, and then it looks like Leah Crane's newsletter is just the New Scientist newsletter. So
Okay. All right.
It does not have a cute name. Right. But she has
I get their newsletter. I get the New Scientist newsletter. Yeah. So that may be.
So you already have Leah's.
Perfect. Jeremy wanted to know, Mika and David, too, assuming there would be another Stargate show, what role do you think that AI would take in it? Not the scary replicator kind. Would we be using AI to help us explore the cosmos? I mean, would we be... Yeah.
I would argue it was already being used for all the times where you have, like, dear computer, fix the thing. Yeah. Which we had anytime we were doing any of the ancient tech. We just were very bad at interfacing with it.
Yeah.
And didn't always understand it. But like, if you think about Stargate Universe, every time they're trying to work with the Destiny computer, especially the chair, how is that if that isn't an AI, right? Like, are we saying that Rush was just really good at hallucination? Because otherwise, he's got a very vivid imagination. And should possibly give up his career as a scientist to instead be a novelist.
Right.
It's a fair point.
Exactly. Entertainment, very key when in deep space.
Right.
David, what do you think?
The cruise morale up.
About in the next Stargate iteration. How would that unravel?
It's an interesting one because as you say, I think there's that weird thing that happens where we're processing huge amounts of information, right? That's all being handled by a lot of machine learning in many cases. Mm-hmm. So I think it's almost not as sexy anymore. Mm-hmm. It used to be, a big glowing disc that you talk to. Now we all have them in our kitchens and they're called, Alexa or whatever. So I feel like the shine has come off that now. I think it's going to be, I honestly think, if anything, I would say AI, while it probably plays a lot of, it'll certainly play a huge part in the effects, I'm sure. I mean, the compositing stuff you can do now is all AI based, where you give it a foreground, it takes the background out for you. You can do your visual effects that way. You can even generate images with that. I think certainly in the production of a new show, AI would be huge, absolutely huge. But as a character in it, I feel like we're almost there now. I mean, I could see it as sort of an alien race being an issue for us, a replicator like race of intelligence, but of super intelligence type thing. But maybe implants. I could see sort of a hybrid. I could see a data-like character in there that's got the technology that would allow them to process the amounts of information we have to process a little better. And McKay would hate him.
Of course, absolutely.
Shut up. I'll get it.
Outsourcing of the data analysis chunk of it, of the like, hey, do all the boring bits for me. Because that's how scientists, like, a lot of sci-fi is taking what we have and extending it out and going, well, what next? And right now it's the, here, data analysis, do my statistics, do my pattern finding. The human asks the question. And the being a really good scientist often involves more how do you ask and frame and think about questions than it does the skills of analyzing the data. Understanding how to collect the data and frame the data and process the data are all like, that's part of asking the question. But asking a question that can be answered by the data and understanding the limits of your questions, that's where we're at right now. Almost a character that goes, well, actually, that isn't the question that you're asking. Actually, this is like causation, it's not correlation.
It's like the prompt, you need like a prompt engineer. As well, along with the, you're asking the wrong question.
Framing is everything.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. What about if we ask this other question?
Yeah.
So there we go. We have a toddler. We would need a toddler to be with us to just ask, but why? But why? But how?
That's it. AI toddler. I love it. It's here to learn as well. And as it learns, it would pick up things as well. That would be a fascinating character, like a character that, I guess that is a kind of a data-like thing as well, but the idea of like an AI that comes on the journey with you and is there to learn. That's it. It's basically a shadow for us. We can only start gleaning information once it's had enough information, to take in.
Yeah. So we did, like, Data is in an adult body, but occasionally has very childlike questions as they learn. And occasionally we have the villain character who's in a childlike body and has very adult views on things. But having a childlike character in a childlike body being like, you're just followed around by a very inquisitive toddler. There's that meme about you turn on the alerts for the BC science focus and you just have, like, what is this? What is it? Like, just popping up on your phone constantly.
It's like a kid.
Yeah. Well, there you go. That's the character. It's just, like, wandering around.
Just asking
why?
Questions. Which is usually my job, to be honest. Because normally I walk around on set asking, what does that do? What's that camera? What's that? What's that? It was always like the joke was I spent more time walking around trying to figure out how they were making these things as I was, you know, as I was actually doing the acting. I was just so fascinated. One of the things I loved about filming is just the whole process of it. The whole extraordinary machine that's required
you're
to
learning.
Make this thing happen.
Yeah,
that's it. You got to learn. That's it. I think that's the curiosity thing is the curiosity is a superpower.
Philippe Canat, question for Mika and David. According to Brad Wright, and this recently came up in an interview, contacting Destiny would have been successful with the help of Rodney McKay. According to you guys, what would have been the solution used here, do you think?
You can ask me to McKay this?
Yeah. McKay it, McKay.
The solution would have been to snap your fingers a lot, get snappy at Zelenka, and then
wormhole drive.
Hit buttons. Yeah, that's it. Randomly hit buttons until Mika comes up with a solution for it.
What was always, like, my favorite thing was actually always coming up with the wrong answers because you can't get to the solution right away, right? You have to have everything break first. Yeah. So coming up with everything that's wrong and everything that doesn't work. Like Stargate Atlantis brainstorm with like all that was the climate change episode where we had
freeze lightning
Neil deGrasse Tyson and Bill Nye the Science Guy and they're like everyone's showing up in the desert and we're sending heat to a parallel universe and gets locked on. Having all the ways in which things do not work was so much fun for the background science of like what doesn't happen. What are all the solutions we don't try or that we try and fail. So coming up with things that don't work is a key part of the science consulting process and definitely my favorite part of plausibly bad ideas. So plausibly bad ideas, trying to do something to amplify the communication stones, maybe set up some sort of resonance on that. Maybe doing like we've done interdimensional bridges before, so maybe a multi-universe bridge hop, like treat one like we can't wormhole from here to here, but maybe we can go to another universe and back. Trying to get ahead of the Stargate network, so trying to like brute force dialing every possible gate combination. There's a way to use AI.
Oh, AI, there you go. Yeah. Perfect. There you go.
Be like, what are the most plausible things based on what we know about how the ancients structured their gate system to anticipate future addresses for gates that we have not yet visited?
Because there is a logic to it.
Like we did with the periodic table.
Yeah.
It's exactly like the periodic table, trying to poking in the bits that we could. Yeah, exactly.
So can we create a periodic table of gate addresses?
Yeah.
For an energy source, what can we have as like astrophysical energy sources for this? This gets into the field astrophysics, which I always wanted, of like, let's just set up a space station around a really exotic star and just be like, let's experiment.
Yeah.
Like, astrophysics and geophysics, really the only actual difference between the scientists is whether or not you get to poke it with a stick. On one side you can, on the other you can't, but astrophysics would totally love to be able to poke their science with a stick. So getting that opportunity
very,
and
very
having
big
that,
stick.
Like,
yeah.
Exactly. And
very
the
long
improvisational
stick.
Capacity of that would be super fun and be able to be like, can we like go find a star, use it as a direct, we've gotten our stargates accidentally locked on black holes before.
Yeah.
We've used the power of a solar flare to do time travel before. Clearly we can use astrophysical batteries. Can we harness one in order to get the power to do this?
Yeah. And then
and
wireless
screw up, but you
wireless day, energy transfer. Yeah.
Which is just light, which I mean, makes it even more fun. And then all the different stars and astrophysical bodies could be different ones that fail for this. Maybe finding like a nice big brown dwarf or a really big Jupiter-sized planet. Maybe finding a couple of those and being like, all right, we need to be like Goldilocksing which one has the exact right dimensions in order to be a good power source. So
Wow.
You know, those could all be great bad answers.
Yeah.
Like, where do you,
have you
right?
gone through, did you go through like every Stargate episode and detail the science? What did you, how do you get to the point where you know enough about what has happened in the past on this show?
So the very, very first science was all done by prop master Kenny Gibbs with his high school physics textbook.
Right, right.
And then eventually it got handed off to Steve Conboy, who is one of my friends, a string theorist who now lives in South America. And his thesis shows up in Stargate before he ever published it in science papers. So I know the science from that because I know Steve, and I was one of his friends while he was writing his thesis. So I know that chunk of it. And then I got to take over, so I know it. So it's like the evolution of the science was... I have the file folders still. If we ever make another Stargate, I've now digitized most of them, but I've got my, like, all the reference papers we use and like which formulation of Stargate do we use? Cause there's a whole bunch of possibilities and what flavor of time travel have we used in Stargate in the past so that we can be consistent with that. And then some of the characters, the alien glyphs are used consistently throughout the years that Steve picked one for a particular thing and I just kept using it, or I got to assign one and now I know what it is and keep using it. So it's a lot of reference material.
We need like a Mika bot. We need like a Mika AI that will just go and we can ask it questions with the ChatGPT type thing, you know?
There we go.
We'll ask Stargate questions.
Yeah. Lock Watcher. That's question amazing. For Mika. Many of the 3D printers available can duplicate many of their own parts now. RepRap project, evidently. Do you think that our 3D printers that we use now are precursors towards replication system?
Oh, yeah. And I mean, flat out, that's what we call them on the International Space Station. We're calling it a replicator when we send up the raw supplies in order to make the tools on demand. It was a big deal to be able to do that. It's challenging when you're in a fully sealed environment because, you know, outgassing, and you've got to be very low rate waste on it. Anyone who thinks that the solution to our environmental problems is go to another planet needs to understand if you're doing deep space, reduce, reuse, recycle gets just amplified, right? Like yesterday's coffee is tomorrow's coffee. You harness that, you get everything redone. So yeah, I'd absolutely say that 3D printers are primitive replicators. And that we're just getting more sophisticated in the printing materials over time. And then apparently making it universal because that doesn't ever break to make everything and all in one solution.
So Prusa, the guy whose printer I have, who I've loved, amazing guy who's built this company, he's got a whole printing farm that basically prints printers. So he's got a whole rows and rows of printers that are printing the components for the next printers. When this one, we had an issue with, there was another one, actually an earlier one, that one of the parts broke just from me carrying it around probably. And again, one of my tech bandits just 3D printed another part and rebuilt it with that part on the same printer.
Yeah.
So basically fixed the printer with the printer. I think we're almost there. I mean, you know,
that's wild. International Space Station has the Canada arm, but it has also the hand Dexter. And Dexter and the arm together are the first self-repairing space robots in that they went around and fixed themselves just to see if they could.
I didn't know about that.
How wild is that?
Wow.
How wild is that?
Yeah, I mean, it was just like this tiny little checkbox thing where you're like, well, we could send the astronauts out on a spacewalk. But as we said, humans are fragile and have, you know, biological needs.
So
it takes a huge amount of time to do a very small task. And then they're in like big bulky gloves and it's exhausting and all of that. Or you could set the robot to do it.
Yeah.
Just go for it. So that would be
another design something
sort of
specifically. Design something specifically for the job, as opposed to us who just are. We're not the backbreaking work, the repetitive stuff. All that stuff needs to be replaced by robots.
It's how is AI used in sci-fi? Well, I mean, we already kind of did this with things like having the little like robots that can replicate and generate whatever particular screw or nut or bolt it needs in order to do the thing of the repair task.
Like the exocomps in Next Gen.
Exactly. Mm. Just make them a background. They're it's a Swiss Army knife. It's not anything exciting. It's a really boring tool that you use to go out and do the things. Like it's not exciting. It's just data crunching. It's getting rid of all the boring bits.
Yuki at home. I loved the classic MALP. from SG-1 and was the first few seasons of Atlantis. What would the 2023 MALP look like? Or would it be pretty identical?
I would want better wheels. Better wheels and tracks. Like, to be better all-terrain on that, let's borrow from Boston Robotics. With super creepy robots that can get over better things.
The dogs.
Or get the search and rescue robots that are go into like piles of collapsed rubble and all that. I also want more geophysics tools. So borrow from like the Mars rovers of the, hey, can you zap with the laser and artificially taste your rocks? Can you sample the atmosphere and tell me more about it? Like, just amp up the tool sets.
And flight. There should be a flying component as well, for sure.
Yeah. UAVs.
You want to scan. You want to scan your area. That's the way to do it. I mean, it's just,
exactly.
Yeah, we'd always be using something like that.
Humans should be superfluous. Humans are the extra. We get to be the analysis. We get to, we get to ask better questions than the toddler does, apparently. So really, I'm saying that we should replace SG teams with toddlers.
Right.
Who just sit there and ask the robo toddlers. They have one responsible adult who has to keep them from like all jumping off cliffs by mistake.
Right. Or Sam. Yeah.
Or Sam.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. The one responsible adult.
Because it ain't gonna be McKay, you know that.
And that they don't need to have humanoid bipedal shapes because we're not particularly efficient. Mm-hmm. And that would be the first exploration team, and then you can send in the squishy humans to like go do
to negotiate with the life forms that they've discovered or whatever. Yeah.
Exactly. You do the upfront diplomacy.
Batmull,
I can hear my human alarms going off in the background there, so I need to wrap up pretty fast.
Okay. So, Mika, I really appreciate you coming on and taking time with us again. So
thank you so much. It's just fascinating, Mika. It's just amazing. I love getting to do this.
It's really
always
cool.
Fun.
Absolutely. David, can you stick around for a few minutes?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can we do it that way? All right, Mika, we're going to let you go. I really appreciate you taking the time. It is always a pleasure to have you on. And best of luck with the young ones.
Enjoy.
Thank you. Oh, always. I'll get to ask lots of questions. How? Why? What?
Exactly right. You take care of yourself. Bye-bye. All right, let me set this up so I can have myself here for a few more minutes.
Of course.
All right. Hang on just a
second.
Poor
Mika, guys. Man, you got to be run ragged.
I know.
3-year-old and a, what did she say, 3-month-year-old?
So yes.
Year-old at the end of it.
Sorry,
it's
everyone,
so long, I can't
seeing
get this. Never got that right.
How I make the sausage here.
Oh, really? Cool.
So, excuse me.
Please do not look behind the curtain.
Pay no attention to the man behind
the curtain. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain.
That's it. David, I got a couple questions for you.
By all means.
I think we've explored this one a while ago, but I'm interested in your assessment now. Let me see here. Here it is. Jeremy wanted to know, if there had been a season 6 of Atlantis, what direction would you have liked to see the character take?
Well, I've always said I would love an evil McKay. Yeah. Always wanted to do some kind of an evil McKay. You know, we talk about AI. I actually had AI write a little evil McKay episode for me. Not an entire episode, but I just thought I was curious to see what it would come up with. And it was actually it was kind of fascinating. It came up with the idea of a scene. It was a montage of the two McKays on different planets arguing about why they work the way they work. So basically, the battle between the evil and the good McKay was just basically us having arguments with each other about what different forms of science we felt were more accurate or not. So each one trying to prove each other smarter than the other so that the bad guy could, like, bad McKay wasn't going to kill him until he knew that he was actually smarter than him.
Until he knew. Isn't that wild?
Yeah, so, wow. Yeah, that was a storyline that I always really want. It was like a classic 1980s TV thing for me. When growing up watching television in the 70s and 80s, there was always like the evil. There was always the bad, the bad twin of some sort, or brother or whatever. So
would you have done any more or have liked to have done any more of two McKays in one scene or perhaps more? Or was that just technically exhausting? It's like,
if
you had your choice, not do that again.
It's that weird thing of, I mean, it's a bit like a lot of the roles I play. They're absolutely miserable at the time, but they're so much fun, if that makes sense. I think I've got a weird sort of sadistic, masochistic quality to myself where I feel like I feel like I it, if you're somehow in pain, it makes for a better
It's worth the
makes for a
trouble.
better show. Yeah, it really is. It's like theater. I mean, who would do theater? It's not theater's not theater's not comfortable. Theater's incredibly uncomfortable. You know, you're in front of a stage, you don't know, you think could go wrong. There's so many, you know, there's so many possibilities. I found it absolutely exhausting. Yeah, absolutely exhausting. But at the same time, what a great role and what an opportunity. Like I was I think, you know, I think also the technologies are better now. I think it would be easier to do now than it was back then. You know, the compositing would have been insane back then. So we had these motion controlled, you know, cameras and such. I think the technology now to make a show with multiple McKays would be a lot easier now. And I think as a result, maybe a lot easier. Now I say that it'd be a lot easier for them to shoot it. That means I'm gonna have more lines, though, isn't
But your timing would still have to be spot on. You
Oh
know, I mean that's the trick. You have to be internally consistent. And that I mean, when you're not in control of which takes are going to be used, that's got to be
Oh, it's
madness.
so, yeah, it really is. Well, and also you start getting frustrated because you're going like, oh, damn, they're gonna keep that one because technically it's better. The performance is better in that one that they're going to throw on the editing floor. Yeah, it's but that's always the trade-off I find with as an actor, you don't have control over that stuff. I mean, you don't. I mean, I guess there's some actors do, but I don't. You know, where you just have to, you just got to do your best every time and hope that they can, you know, that they can piece something together from it. You know, it's basically the way it
Are
works.
you completely divorced from it when you see it on television for the first time, or are you still saying to yourself, even though you know you've said that, given that you know pep talk to yourself, I liked that other take, I liked it. You know
It's
what can I? And they
this.
didn't use it, so.
It's happened on some stuff. There's definitely some stuff where I've gone like, ah, really? Like we're there. Why are we on that shot? Like there's definitely times you do that, but I'm also having done some editing and directing and stuff. You realize that it's just not all about you. Weirdly,
No, that's
it's
true.
not all about me.
Yeah,
You know, it's there's so many other things that could come into play, and it's no point in having a great acting performance by you if you're watching a grip in the background holding a tree. You know what I mean? Like it's not. That's, you know, like, but again, the tools are getting so much better now that you can fix a lot of those problems in post. I think it's gonna, in a way, it's gonna be easier to get better performances. It's just harder to know. Yeah, you never know what they're gonna do with stuff
I
anyways.
remember being backstage when you were filming Adrift, and you were trying to get Shepard to, you know, accept your apology. You know, and like, I know I screwed up, and you may have some cause for feeling this way, blah blah blah. And I remember you going through the speech again and again, and I'm thinking to myself, "Ooh, that's a good take. I'd like to see that. Ooh, that's a good take. I hope that was it." And then when it airs, it's like, you know, they have thought of it all in terms of the larger piece, and it is represented in the larger piece, not the individual scene. That's the most important.
And that's it. And that's what it comes down to. The other thing that you realize very quickly, well, first off, there's two things I do. One is I have this, I don't know where this, when this snapped into place. It used to be that I would watch the stuff I was in. All I could watch was myself. It was, you know, it was. I've got to this weird point now in my career where it's another person. I go like, oh, he didn't do a good job on that, or oh, he didn't do, oh, that didn't work as well for him. It's literally like a different person. But I also know I've got no control over it. So it's like there's a kind of a weird sense of release now where I'm just like, yeah, great, they did what they, you know, that's. And the other thing you realize is that they don't see the other takes, so. If you're there and you see the rehearsals and you go, oh, there's three, four takes there. Oh man, those were all great. If only, and then the last one where they finally it all worked is not as good. No one's seen the other stuff,
That's
so
true.
it works in a whole different way than it did before. So yeah, it's a thing that's always bothered me about acting is the lack of control. There's a, you know, I've always been very envious of like painters who could just grab a blank canvas and paint something, and then it's like there. That's what was in my head. That's on the page. Done.
Or Tom
You
Cruise,
know.
who can say, "I want that one."
Well, that too. Yeah, that's true.
I want. I'm curious. I wonder why you have divested yourself from, you know, that other person who did that. Is it just kind of like it's been so long, you're really not that person anymore, or is it, you know,
That's weird. It
something
happens even
else?
with newer stuff. Even newer stuff now, I find. I was just going through, I just had to put together another demo reel because my demo reel, I realized, was so old. It's like they're gonna, if they hired me and I showed up on set, they're like, you know, like, no, we wanted to hire your son. So I thought I better redo my demo. And I was going through all the old stuff, and it really was. I was like, ah, why did he do that? That's not gonna work. So it's just, and again, it doesn't work for me in the in for the for the demo. It works fine for the show, but for me, I wanted to be able to cut there. I wanted to be able to. So it's just, it's what everyone has their own little kingdom to worry about within the film industry. And whether it's a sound issue or a lighting issue or a directing thing or a writing thing, or everyone has reasons why they need things to change. And also, what's best for you is rarely best for the show. That's the other thing. I think there's a certain sense of like, I think there are actors who come in and it is them and it is about them and it's all about them. It could be amazing actors, but it doesn't necessarily make for a good show, because if you're the only one, if you shine in a show that no one else no one else can get a look in, and you're not, it's not a good show, is it? So
You joked, oh, that's not the person I thought. I wanted your son. Has Baz indicated any interest in getting into the family
no.
business?
No, he mocks and derides what I do for a living
So
all the
that's
time, and I
it.
love him for
So,
it. Yeah,
okay.
I've been a little conniving about it in that I've really pushed for him. I mean, if God forbid he scrapes the barrel and ends up being an actor, then I guess that I would support him in anything he does. If he showed a love for it, I would absolutely support it in every way. But I have not, definitely not made it easy for him. And I just don't. It's also like the funny thing is, like, if I was back at his age now, I'm not sure that I would pursue it as a profession. I mean, like, it's a very different world than it was when I, like, when we came into, when I came into acting and films and TV were, we set the trends. We were the news. It was, that was everything. That's, everyone wanted to be a famous actor or a famous musician, basically. Those are the two things. Maybe sports, I guess there were sports stars as well. But that's just not the same anymore. There are YouTubers who are doing like crazy cool stuff, building empires of their own. I mean, I think of Hacksmith and stuff, who are just doing their own, who built their own empires, doing exactly what they want to do. And there's so many more opportunities out there for people
True.
that might have that extrovert desire, like I did for some reason. But what was that? I'm in the garage, so I hear everything.
Got a couple more minutes?
I do. Yeah.
I watched Pin a couple of months ago,
Oh, wow. Classic.
and
Yeah.
I loved it.
It's pretty wild, isn't it?
That was wild. I am a huge Terry O'Quinn fan,
Oh,
so
he's fantastic.
that was
Oh, my
really
God. What a guy.
That
What a
was
guy.
really exciting to see. And Kate had always said, you look at him in that age, he's like a young Jude Law. And I'm like, yeah, that, I can see it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. What was that role like? Or do you look back on that going, oh my God, Pin,
It was fantastic. It was like,
Yeah.
it was, I mean, it was my first really big role. It was the first lead, basically. And I didn't have a clue what I was doing, and I was so nervous, and I did so much research, probably too much research, but I was at, this is back in before the days of the internet, I was at the public library looking up stuff about psychosis, and I did a whole, like, I just, being the nerd that I am, one of the joys of acting is you get to learn a lot, lots of, it was a little bit about a lot of things, basically. And that was one of those things. And I was reading like Manson's diaries and all sorts of, like, just trying to get a sense of what this,
Psychosis.
how does one split on one's personality like this? And so just, and I had so much, like, weirdly had a lot of fun with that, with the research part of it as well. And also it's my first time out really out of the city on, I'd been out, I'd traveled around a little bit, but it was my first job out of the city. So I was in Montreal. It was a fantastic city. And Cindy Preston, absolutely lovely, lovely actress who played my sister. Terry was like, we were like in awe of Terry. And he was
So
absolutely
good.
lovely. Great director. Sandor Stern did an amazing job on that. It's a weird little film, and it comes up all the time. I'm really
Really?
proud of it. Like, I've seen, one of the great things about being a Canadian actor is you can have lots and lots of work and no one knows who you are. And by the time I got to Pin, I'd done a lot of little things. So I'd got the technical stuff out of the way, so that when you get a chance to play a role like that, you can just kind of just let the role, you can roll with it, so to speak. I just, oh God, I loved it. Absolutely loved it. I also love playing those uptight kind of, those almost like vibratingly tense
Oh man, absolutely. Characters. These kids did not have childhoods. Their parents had plastic on the furniture. Yeah. You know, the story in a nutshell is about an anatomy doll from his father's doctor's office, whom may or may not be sentient. No, I like watching it because there are a couple of scenes, especially just before some of the characters die in a car crash, that almost suggests that there may be a demonic presence in this thing. You can look at it that way, or you can look at it as just a straight up psychotic group of people, you know?
Yeah, it was around the time of you know, what is it, the Flowers for Algernon, and there was a whole bunch of these different, did I get the right one? I'm not sure if that was called. There's a bunch of these weird, slightly sort of incestuous kind of family, weird relationships between brothers and sisters and stuff that was sort of popular in that era. And Sandy, I guess, had written the Amityville Horror, I guess, the movie. So, and he just did a great job with that. I mean, just a fantastic job with that film, I thought. I mean, it's weirdly funny. It's got a weird sense of humor to it. There's definitely some 80s moments, but you know, there's definitely some questionable stuff. But it was a wonderful role. I mean, God, you couldn't wish for more.
Yeah, and I think it still holds up, you know, even in an 80s product. And there's a couple of twists in it that definitely did surprise me. Like, well, now that character is gone. Wow, they're okay. You know, I mean, there's it's worth going out there and watching. I just wish it was available to stream somewhere, and it's not right now. So
is it not? Is it not? No, it's not streamable.
No, I had to go to the high seas to get it. But
really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But it's a great film, and anyone out there who enjoys David's work, I highly recommend seeking it out. And
it's a good Halloween one. You want to watch a good Halloween? Yeah.
You should
watch Pin, and then watch Cabinet of Curiosities, the Rats episode, and you could just see it's like a time lapse between my first show and one of my latest.
I have not seen that. I need to sit down and watch.
Oh, you're not? Oh,
I have not. No, but Del Toro is brilliant.
Yeah, you know? Well, and Vincenzo directed it. Vincenzo, the guy who did Cube, directed it.
Okay. So it's
the two of them, between the two of them, it's magnificent.
David, it's always great to have you on. It's great
Likewise,
to see
man.
You.
I'm sorry it was such a nuisance to get us together.
No, you know, we made it work out. And you have a wonderful holiday season. And
you too.
I'd love
Enjoy.
To have you and Kate back for season 4next
year.
Yes,
we should do it. Yeah, let's do a Kate and I. I think it'd be better to have a Kate and I together rather than I thought it wasn't fair on Mika to have.
Oh, no, I wasn't going to have the three of you. I was going to have the two of you if Mika couldn't show up. But yeah, no, I'll reach out to her and put a pin in her ear. Pardon the pun.
I'll try to talk her out of it and tell her she's not wanted or loved. Yeah, that kind of stuff.
Pleasure,
oh, and
sir.
I will say, if anyone watching this is in the Paris region, I'm going to Paris next week for it's Paris Manga and Sci-Fi Expo, and I've been to it once before. It's really fun, so I'm rather looking forward to going back. Paris, I haven't been to a convention for ages now.
By
so
TGS, is that sci-fi show? Oh, yeah, look at this! Yeah. I'm posting this right now. This is great. Very cool. So this is next weekend.
Next weekend, yeah. Oh, is it next weekend?
Is
oh
it?
My God, it is! It's next weekend. Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah,
wow,
and
this
I
is a great lineup. There you
I haven't
are.
Done a big convention in a long time.
Yeah.
So I am really looking forward to getting back out there again.
28th October. That's it.
Be there.
And Tony Amendola. Very cool.
Yeah. 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 Right, is it Leah? Is it Leah Pinsent? Leah Thompson? Leah Thompson.
From Back to the Future. Let's see here.
Yeah.
Yes, Leah Thompson. That's right.
Yeah.
Elijah Wood. Yeah, very cool.
Elijah Wood. That's right. Oh, wow. God. I want to talk to Elijah Wood because he did a film with Vincenzo in France years ago. And I'm curious to know if he remembers the experience because, you know, it's interesting.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so if people are there, come say hi. Yeah, and obviously techbandits.org. Go check it out.
I put the link on the description.
That's if people want to sign up for the email of awesome awesomeness, that is the way to do it. I'm just trying to get, you know, as many people as I can because it helps. And it's just kind of fun.
Well, anyone who's interested in that, just go ahead and click on the description below for Tech Bandits. It will take you there.
You rock.
No, fantastic. You rock, sir. Always. Appreciate you.
Thanks,
man.
So much, man.
You take care of yourself, okay?
You too.
I'll close out
and
on this.
Thanks
end.
To all the mods doing their fantastic modding work, with or without hammers.
That's it. Be well, Dave.
Cheers.
David Hewlett, Rodney McKay in Stargate Atlantis. Always a pleasure to have David and Mika on. They were always so fascinating. You know, you think you've heard it all, and it's like, wow, that's a thing. Wow. You know, just the world is always an opportunity to learn something new. I also have an announcement to make. I, along with Joseph Malazzi, we were a part of a French documentary by Stardust, who is on the who's on YouTube, the Air and Space channel, and he put together a Stargate documentary, and I've put a link in the description below regarding that, so you can go and check that out. It's over an hour long, and it's in French and in English, and he's done a great job with interviewing myself, Joseph Malazzi, and the people who were responsible for making a physical Stargate. And it's a French team, and they went ahead and put this thing together, so you can go over there and follow the link below and learn more about how... I'm trying to find the clip from that, but I'm not going to be able to pull that off. So, anyway, there it is. There's one of them. They actually made a French team made a Stargate, and so he has interviewed them as well. So, over at Stardust, the Air and Space Channel, he's done a complete Stargate documentary that I really recommend. It's really cool. We have tomorrow... pull this up here. Mark Savella is going to be joining myself and Jenny Stiven to discuss the state of the visual effects industry. Since the writer's strike and the actor's strike, a lot of the behind-the-camera workers have really been hit hard. And we're going to learn through Mark a little bit more about the process of what it takes to bring so many of the effects that are key to making our favorite shows the process come to life, and how they've been impacted since then. So just bringing a little bit more awareness into the public consciousness of what's going on. Mark did a wonderful article for, it was like an op-ed on Facebook. And if you go over to our page on Twitter X, you can see a link, a reply with the announcement of this particular episode and the complete op-ed that he did. I'll also be posting a shot of it at the beginning of the show tomorrow, but really looking forward to having Mark Savella on and Jenny Stiven to discuss the state of the visual effects industry in Hollywood. And I think it's going to be a good episode. We got a number of shows for you before we finish out our season next weekend, the October the 29th. Go over to dialthegate.com and get the latest rundown of everything that we're going to have. A lot of this stuff is going to be pre-recorded, so I'm just going to post it because this is an insane number of episodes to have the moderators moderate for a premiere. So we're just going to post them. And if you want to comment on it, you can just leave comments in the comments section. My name is David Reed for Dial the Gate. I really appreciate you all tuning in. Thanks to my moderating team, Tracy, Anthony, Summer, Jeremy, Reese. You guys make the show possible. Frederick Marcoux at Concepts Web. He keeps dialthegate.com up and running. My producer, Linda Gate-Gabber-Fury, and my amazing team of transcribers who have been working diligently to transcribe every episode of the show. Hopefully, we'll be releasing those on dialthegate.com in some format fairly soon here. I think we're about halfway through, if not more, at this point. It's a lot of content, and they've been blowing through it. So I really appreciate them. Again, my name is David Reed for Dial the Gate. Thank you so much to David Hewlett and Mika McKinnon for joining us. I'll see you on the other side. Dial the Gate is hosted and executive produced by David Reed. The producer is Darren Sumner. Co-produced by Linda Fury. The composer is Neil Acree. Animations by Bryce Orrs. The production assistant is Jennifer Kirby. Moderators include Summer Roy, Keith O'Mell, Tracy Noller, Jeremy Heiner, Reese M., and Anthony Rowling. Logo design by Deborah J. Bell. Additional effects by Thomas Tots, with contributions by model makers Chris Baker, Stephen Barr, Kevin Zabo, and Tom Paris. The archivists are Linda Fury, Zachary Adams, and Fred Eric Marcoux. For general inquiries for submissions, please contact us at dialthegateshow@gmail.com. Visit our website for the upcoming schedule, as well as an archive of our past episodes at dialthegate.com.